Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thank you for showing up again. I have no idea what to talk about, but I do know what my purpose is. I started the show about a year ago, give or take. Almost a year ago, sometime this month. And when I started, I was trying to experiment with different creative processes. I found myself to be a consumer, and during a spiritual journey one night, I decided that I needed to make steps towards being less of a consumer and producing more of my own content. It was about this time last year, if not a couple months beforehand, that I started asking questions on social media under the guise of my topics, where I would ask vague questions as bait, often rhetorical, in hopes of getting feedback so that I may further conversate and question those that I was acquainted with. And I had had some success and some failures with my topics. Towards the beginning, I would insult and often confuse my participants because I was unaware of my own intentions with my experiment. And I learned a lot from these conversations. And from there, I started to talk to other people, strangers on other groups with the same intent. And in a fashion and with a vigor that I haven't maintained ever since, I spent a lot of time, probably too much time, on social media during this time period. And I just can't do it anymore. I'm too tired. Or I learned what I needed to in that moment, and I don't feel like I need to anymore. I don't spend nearly as much time on social media anymore. But it was during this time period that I decided to start the show. And I'm really glad I did. But when I started, I didn't have any purpose. And what's cool is after a year of doing this and continuing to talk and spread whatever message I am spreading, which I feel driven to do, and yet I do feel is an organic process and it will change. But nowadays, I see this project as an attempt to inspire curiosity through creativity. And this is by instituting a necessary focus by defining what is important to ourselves. And I do this through literature and through seeking and searching. And your way may be incredibly different than mine. Your way may not even be filled with any of my tidbits of ideas and opinions, which is something I would further like to go into tonight. I would also like to push love on this show. And I know love is a vague term, whether you look at the Greek Eros or Cupid's violent arrow full of misapprehension. Love to me is a much simpler thing that I do not believe that I could define with a simple definition. Yet I do believe that we are all amazing and inspiring creatures, whether we are human or an ant that crawls upon a blade of grass. Every speck of life carries within it this decadence that inspires compassion, even if on the guise of the face of the moment, all you see is violence. And that isn't to excuse thoughtless violence, but I do truly believe that at the center of our existence is this spark. And that's what I call love. And some others might call many other terms. And I'm trying not to go into any religiosity because I do not find myself to be a particular religious person, even though segments of my message resonate heavily with religious doctrine. Because as a very smart man once said, a late Mr. Ram Dass, there are many paths up the mountain, but at the very top, they all lead to the same place. And we're all walking each other home anyways. Anywho's, I recently started a wonderful text by a man named John Stuart Mill, which I'm not going to give you a biography right now. If you want to know more about the man, you can look him up. One of the ideas that I'm pulling from is from an essay called On Liberty, which was written with a heavy influence by his wife, who he adored and loved incredibly. And he was a pro-feminist figure in the 1850s, the mid-1800s, many decades within that time frame. But it was unheard of almost, at least to hear about now, of feminist pro-feminist figures, especially men, coming out of, I think it was England. He was a utilitarian, and utilitarianism is a segment of philosophy that belongs strongly to Western philosophy, which deals with empiricism, which is trial by error, and the acquiring of evidence through experiment and collection. And idealism, which is the thought that there is a rationale or a reason which configures and glimpses your world, or some sort of blend of these two. Western philosophy is far different than Eastern, which is what I've been consumed with and will continue to be consumed with. But I haven't talked enough about different ideas here on the show, which is why this week I would like to bring up Mr. John Stuart Mill. Utilitarianism is based around the idea of utility. Now, we're not talking about utility belts here, Batman, but what does utility mean to you? Take a second. What do you find utility in? Do you find yourself to have utility? So for the utilitarian, utility can be usefulness, is the way that I primarily see it. Though many utilitarians choose to say that the basic utility in life is happiness, which hedonism at its gross extreme can displace humanity for happiness. And it can be very hard to argue whose happiness is more powerful or has more effect than another's. If a group's happiness is worth the death of one individual, does it not make sense to sacrifice that individual? What if it was for the gods? You see, utility has holes in it as a philosophy, but when glimpsed from afar and we look and we carry our baskets into the garden of belief and we look for the ripe fruits that we choose to gather, there are many useful factors within utilitarianism, at least when choosing to decide how to build our own ethical or moral core. I would also agree that some breed of happiness, but a very complex breed, not a simple breed of just pleasure, happiness can be buried within sacrifice as well, and within a tense moment when we help another. And even though it might not be for our happiness, I believe that that still serves the utility of the situation when we help another. So when used on a micro scale and with a case-by-case basis and through very clean and scrubbed and inspected lenses that we are building within however we decide is ethical or right, or justice, you know, it could be useful to have some sort of system of at least deciding which action could serve to help more, or at least help ourselves have a more constructive and safer vantage point for that moment, right? So broadly, this is the schoolish of thought, which I am no master and I am no king philosopher, like the brilliant Marcus Antoninus Aurelius, the philosopher king. I'm no philosopher king or emperor. And honestly, I do feel that I am a philosophical infant and am very stupid on many of these things. So take any bit of biography or explanation with a grain of salt. I do hope that you can test me. And with that hint of doubt that you may have with me, I hope that inspires you to go further look into the situation and to learn more about utility and utilitarianism for yourself. But from his essay that I started recently, which is On Liberty, I found this word that I've heard mentioned many times before. It was even a section in the very easy tests of my educational career, which was, is this statement a fact or an opinion? Which is a question that we ask children, that I was asked as a child, that I was given a statement and given the responsibility to be a truth-sayer at a very young age and decide whether a statement could hold this mystical idea called truth, which the skeptic would completely deny and throw out. But I don't think I want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. You see, I do think that there is an essence of truth to be had in life. I do feel that it might be completely relative, you see? Now, what is a relative truth versus, say, an objective truth? Relative truth would be keenest in the eye of the beholder, from the subjective viewpoint of the consciencee, the one witnessing reality. Whereas objective truth would be a omnipotent truth that will always be. One of the classical examples of such an objective truth would be gravity or the celestial movements that have been witnessed since the dawn of human civilization and existence. And those celestial movements that I'm hinting to loosely is the rising of the sun and the moon. The sun will set tonight, but it will rise tomorrow. And this can be seen because it has always happened. It has never not risen. So gravity will always pull me down. Whether or not I exist, there will be gravity. Whether all of life on the planet is extinguished by some apocalyptic event, there will still be gravity. So such a truth that exists outside of the subjective being. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't certain things that exist and are always. Of course, there are going to be things outside of me. In fact, most of existence is outside of me. But the way that I experience my reality is guided by what I have witnessed empirically. And so my assumptions and my expectations are built around those initial perceptions. I was speaking with a friend today about our children, and speaking about my son. And I was trying to portray how I believe that my son has, well, he was recently diagnosed by a psychologist through heavy observation with ADHD and ODD. I'm much more interested in ODD, which is oppositional defiance disorder. It is part of a broader group of whatever you call those diagnoses, called antisocial disorders. There's pro-social antisocial, and then there's negative antisocial, where you get psychopathic or sociopathic behavior where somebody is so bound within their own manipulations of their world, and they do not no longer care about the others around them, so they then manipulate them. ODD is not like that. ODD is pro-social. My son cares a lot about other people's feelings and is very empathetic towards others and the harm that they may incur, even by his own mistakes and decision making. And so he is hurt a lot by his own actions through shame and guilt. He's just having a difficulty relating with others. And I relate heavily to him because I feel that this is very present in my own personality. And so I was explaining to her that when anything happens, we don't ever experience what we actually do. We do something and we witness the action from our own viewpoint and our own reasoning. We don't see how it lands when it lands on the outside. And once it lands on the outside, we don't know how that other felt. And all we then see is the reaction of the other. So we are seeing a reflection of our action back at us. And I think this is rather complicated to be able to analyze and to be able to incorporate into a judgment of the situation. You see? And so I think it's very natural. I think that just as some kids might struggle learning certain arithmetic steps, such as 4 + 4 = fish, that some kids may not be able to immediately have a well-working ability to analyze reactions and systems on what they're doing. And I think this might have to do with what some may call antisocial, which doesn't necessarily have to be introversion or extroversion. I hope you see the difference. It doesn't have anything to do with wanting to be alone within the socialness. It just has to do with how we interact with others. So I do think that a lot of these truths are relative to the person who is collecting them. And once we've collected them, we may mistakenly label our assumption of a truth as a fact. Just as when I was sitting in front of that test and given a fact or opinion questionnaire, you know, is it really responsible for any individual to have a perfect truth-saying device or compass within themselves that can sense truth from the outside? Can we realistically do that? Is that reasonable to say? Are some people more equipped to do it better? Are more others incapable, and we label them as banal? Is that right? So, how about within relative truths, everything that I hold dear being simple opinions, and looking at myself as a fallible individual? I have been proven wrong so many times before. And it's not just me. Ages of civilization have been proven wrong when we look backwards. The way and the judgments and the science or natural philosophy of the Dark Ages, the way that spirits flew through the blood and acquired humors, or where sickness was an infestation by a demon in need of exorcism. You see, the beliefs of whole ages of people where it was common doctrine and maybe dogma have been proven wrong, and through the lens of time and history may seem foolish. And those were truths too. Those were truths to masses of people. Is a truth simply what is commonly accepted by the broad group of people? I hope not. John Mill seemed to push others to vet themselves by consistently looking to others to share their own opinions and trying to find counterarguments to beat their own beliefs. If there's something that you hold most dear, you go find the best counterargument. And if nothing beats it, you can hold it more dearer. Now, some may call this playing the devil's advocate. And I learned from this great art essay again, what the devil's advocate even means, which I was unaware of. During times of papacy, where the Christian church of Catholicism, the Roman Catholic Church, which held the world, or at least the Western world, in huge swaths of people within its thrall for such tremendous amounts of time, when somebody would be put forth, it was expected to find even the devil itself's pawn in reality, and to find the one who speaks for the devil to tell everything about that person. Even when a pope was being elected, it would be expected for the devil itself to come forth and to say everything that that person had done ill or wrong. Because to not expose every single shred of observable surface of a scene, and at worst to deny witnessing it, is only to admit fault and untruthhood. So a devil's advocate is literally the devil coming to help further prove in a case. So when somebody's playing the devil's advocate, you know, we're giving the counter argument. You know, this is also called polemicism. I know a lot of these themes are reiterant, and I'm repeating myself from some past episodes, but I just see shreds of these things reappear again and again. So I want you to consider, especially in a tense moment, when you feel like attacking or defending based upon an idea, maybe we should also consider our fallibility, that we are not perfect, that we are all just independent individuals that cannot glimpse totality from such a small little corner. And don't be arrogant enough to think that you can see it all or to know it all. Even with an entire existence, you can't. And maybe don't be quite so quick to label something truth or to judge your child for failing that section on that test. I had a great day today. Me and Odin met with some friends early this morning around 9 o'clock and went to a really small, off, out of the way waterfall. It was about a mile hike beforehand, going through very steep walled ravine, massive cliffs, you know, like 100 feet tall or more, you know, beautiful evergreens. A lot of storm damage. We had a really heavy snow last week when I was flying in from Arizona that damaged a lot of forest. And now huge sections of forest are being claimed inhumane and unsafe for hiking right now because of all the damage while they clean it up. Just a very heavy snow, right at the beginning of summer, which is very Coloradan. You know, so we were hopping and jumping over a lot of different dump sites where bits of tree had collected. But when we arrived there, it was just absolutely gorgeous. And the kids, you know, were just playing in the water and trying to clean it up. There was lots of like leaves and stuff. And everybody was having a really good time. And my buddy, he brought a DMT pen, which is one of those things that are available now, I guess. And I don't know where you get them, but they're pretty cool and they're very easy. Whereas most of the time when that I've consumed this beautiful substance, I've used the pipe, which I still personally prefer just for ease of access and the ability to get a larger dose. Not that I'm giving any sort of recommendations and or anything. I'm simply commenting on experiences. But it's pretty cool when you're outside and it doesn't look too conspicuous. And it just got me thinking. It's been a while that I've found myself interacting with this beastie. The first time that I ever acquired or ran into it, DMT, which stands for dimethyltryptamine, just a little bit of background information, which this is from psychonautwiki.org, which is a wonderful resource that you can look up, and it has links to other resources, and you can look at subjective and pharmacological and cultural. It's just like Wikipedia, just for things that not everybody talks about. So DMT was discovered by a German chemist named Richard Helmuth Friedrich Mentzke in 1931. Since then, it was also independently found in Brazil by another chemist that I did not write down his name, and then was then further verified a decade later by American chemists and synthesized and blah, 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 blah. And ever since then, it's been pretty well known, and all the scientific community was ran haywire by the spiritualistic movement of the 60s and the 70s, and many scientists were doing things such as the acid testing on prisoners and college students. But a lot of these things leaked out of the labs, and the chemists themselves were also partaking, because I think it is the material spiritualism incarnate on this planet. I do think that these substances, whether it is psilocybin in the mushroom or the DMT from the Mimosa tenuiflora plant or Hostilis or ayahuasca or what have you, I think that these are teachers in a way without voices that help unburden the shackles that keep us bound in earthly existence. It might be a doorway to the beyond, and it might be reminiscent of what death has to bring for us. Of course, these are all only personal genuflections and have absolutely no basis in deductive reasoning. DMT has also been found in 50 plants from 10 different family types all over the world. Also 4 different animals, 3 of which are mammals, and 1 Gorgonian. I'm pretty sure they've also found it in fish. And I have no idea what the fuck a Gorgonian is. I hope Medusa doesn't really exist. And I hope she's not hallucinogenic. Yet, it's been here for a while. It's not as talked about and it's not as heard of, but some people know about it, and it's been gaining popularity in the last couple of years because of people such as Joe Rogan and others. I ran into her because I've personified it to a tremendous amount. I ran into her my second semester of college, almost 10 years ago now. And I was in a very unhealthy stage of my life, and I was using gnarly narcotics that were rotting me from the inside out, but I was still responding and staying, you know, responsible enough and getting through my schooling. So I was at school, but I was vomiting in between classes. And suddenly, an older man, because I was at a community college, an older man came up to me and was like, "Hey, you look kind of sick, man." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, you know, I've had the flu." And he's like, "Nah, dude, don't bullshit me. You know, I know you're dope sick." And I was like, "Oh, shit. Yeah." And he goes, "I have something that I think can help you." And I was just like, okay. But he didn't say what it was. And I had no idea what he was talking about. Yet, I felt comfortable enough with him for some reason that I waited for him after class, and I followed him to his car, to his home, which was in, honestly, a pretty ghetto apartment. And there, he had a wife, and he goes in and he says, "Hey, honey, I brought somebody here to try the DMT." And he showed it to me. And he gave me too much, a very large dose, because he was trying to shock me. He wanted to push me out of the toxic circuitry and cycle that I had put myself in by continuing to rotate and make certain decisions. And that massive dose changed my life, and I fell in love. And it moved me. And I was sitting in a chair, and I had on headphones and a jacket, and I immediately became hot with the rush of serotonin that flew. And as I started to panic and freak out, because I had no idea what was happening to me, And all I knew is that everything was getting very scary, very fast, and quicker than I'd ever seen anything happen in my life. So I violently threw and thrust off my headphone and my jacket, and I sat back in this recliner, and I closed my eyes and found myself in a black, infinite space, apart from the traditional reality that I usually resided within. And I found myself in almost an eggshell, as if my spirit was in a fetal position, surrounded by a thin layer of protection. And a maternal force looked down at my infantile and sick being and spoke without words, but with intention. And I felt tremendous guilt for all the things that I'd done to myself and the lack of compassion that I'd shown myself. I saw myself go into my veins and my organs turn black, and I felt disgust because I was better than that and I was worth it. That was the message she taught me in 5 minutes in a stranger's house while I was very sick. And 10 minutes later, after observing the candy-like expression of geometric pattern interlaid and painted upon every visible surface within the range of my vision, within 10 minutes, I felt the most motivation and love within me that I'd felt in such a long time. And that night, when I even went to go pick up my son's mother, she did not even believe that I'd been telling the truth at how ill I was because of how good I seemed to be. And it's not just the substance. The teacher showed me what I should have been feeling, and the guilt that I should have acknowledged prior that I'd been stuffing down behind shadows and behind pleasure-seeking and behind individualistic and self-willed goals. It let me glimpse behind the screen for a second. And once I'd found the care that I still had, the spark of specialness that I know has always existed within my heart, that is infinite and cannot be scarred or marred by any event or happening, after that, I ran with it because my spark was already there. I just had to look at it. It's not a treating procedure. It's something that's special and isn't meant for everybody. In fact, most people probably shouldn't. Yet, it is curious. And it's continued to make me far more curious throughout the years. Well, anyways, I hope that that was interesting at the least. Thank you for listening. I want you to remember how important you are. I want you to remember that you're special, that you don't always have to be acting. You don't always have to be carrying the weight of the world. You have an infinite power source that is almost dragging you behind it in its wake. And sometimes you can just let it be. Take a breath. Experience the world and love it. Accept who we are. Behind all the guises and clothes and masks that we put on to be able to interface and survive in our world. I'm so grateful that you're here, and I'm so grateful that you're breathing with me. Let's go see what Odin has to say, and we'll sign off for this week. Thank you. I love you. Love yourself too. Let it be.
Welcome to the Ask O and the Gingerbread Man show.
Woo!
Today my dad doesn't have any questions, so I'm just going to tell you about stuff.
Woo!
My wife is doing good.
Woo!
I basically forgot everything. Sorry.
You're perfect, man. You're absolutely perfect. What did we do today?
What?
What did we do today?
today. We're going to tell people how our lives.
What did we do today in our lives?
Today we went to a town. We went to a cool thing.
Did you have fun?
Mm-hmm.
Did you remember to care about yourself?
Yep.
And to show yourself love and compassion?
Yep.
That's perfect.
Okay.
I love you, dude. You want to say bye?
Bye.
Thank you for being here, Odin.
I have one question.
What's your question?
Why is you always being crazy?
I don't know. That's a secret, man.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye.